Thursday night edition of the pod. We're going to preview the East Finals. Also got to get to some news here as well. And then we'll also do a look at the offseason for the New Orleans Pelicans. Almost said Hornets. Wow, that was bad. Let's start, though, by catching up on what is going on around the league. Starting, Danny, with a coaching hire in Charlotte.
Yeah, Charlotte hired. They didn't go on the North Carolina tree. They hired Spurs assistant James Borrego. Pronunciation could be suggested if it is Borrego or something else like that. And I don't know it admittedly a ton about him other than his presence on the Spurs bench, but this was a remarkable year, not necessarily with there was I believe the Bucks job where five different people in the Spurs organization were interviewed. And so this was the first of that group to get a head coaching position somewhere else in the league.
Yeah, and I think Borrego had a largely forgettable stint as interim coach for the Magic. I'm not sure that particularly played in his favor. That of course was not a good Magic team at the time, but I would be hard pressed as well to really say what he stands for other than that he has some head coaching experience as the interim and he was on the, I don't know him that much personally, not a guy who's really been in the limelight. There wasn't much discussion of like particularly what he was responsible for the Spurs. I think a guy who was respected and had certainly had some interviews previously, and I made this point on Twitter the other day that a lot of times you probably wonder, well, why is it that these tweets about coaches getting interviewed, like, you know, why do agents kind of call in favors for that kind of stuff? And the reason is that nobody actually knows who's going to be a good coach until they've coached. And sometimes even when they have coached, they don't look good. Like in their next stop, like Vogel in Orlando, for example, all the things that characterized Frank Vogel in Indiana, he wasn't really able to do those in Orlando. And so when there is a vacuum of information, simply the idea that someone is getting interviews in other places is a currency all its own, right? It's just like, oh, well, if other people see something in this guy and want to interview him, then, you know, there must be something good about it. Maybe we should interview him. Yeah, I think there's a lot of that to it. And so I'm not saying that's the case with Borrego. I have no idea whether he's going to be a good coach in Charlotte or not. I can freely say that. But certainly you'd have to imagine the fact that he got some other interviews, you know, and maybe people don't know the extent of those interviews, whether it's over the phone, whether he's coming out there for 2 days, who knows with some of these guys. But I think this also an indication, you know, Borrego not really near the top of potential coaching candidate, certainly in the popular perception as a hot candidate. And I think that is commensurate with where this Charlotte job is right.
You and I talked about it on a Patreon mailbag about where it ranks, and I think we both had it pretty low, not only due to the ownership situation, which isn't necessarily great there, but because the best player on the Charlotte Hornets might be gone pretty soon. Borrego might not get much of a chance to coach Kemba Walker. We'll have to see, but it will be hard for them to improve, so this might be more of a rebuilding position that might buy them a little bit more time, which is always valuable, but it could be a really hard job.
In Cleveland, despite their dominant victory over the Raptors, there's one person who probably wishes it weren't so dominant, and that's Rodney Hood, because it was such a blowout. He was out of the rotation for Jenny Osmond and then refused to enter the game when summoned in the fourth quarter. That angered a number of teammates. There are reports that a number of teammates were attempting to tell him, hey, you know, you're screwing yourself over here, Rodney. Probably a good idea to go in the game. But he did not. There was a little bit of pushback later that, oh, maybe he was like feeling too stiff to go in and he's been dealing with injury issues or whatever. But just a terrible look. I mean, if you can't play in the game, you probably shouldn't be active. Hood eventually apologized to Kobe Altman. Remains to be seen where he's at with the rest of his teammates, but someone who is not in the rotation, it almost doesn't really matter. And for the organizational standpoint, there's really no point in suspending him. It does seem to be, or fining him. It doesn't appear like he's on a path to necessarily be on this team next year. Although I think if LeBron leaves, it seems more likely that he would be back. Actually, I would say, Danny, you agree with that?
It would certainly make the financial part of it more viable, because otherwise Hood's, because would ratchet up the luxury tax bill for Dan Gilbert. So yeah, I'd say that's fair.
And also they would have a chance, even if they didn't really want him that much, to just keep him around on what would hopefully be a reasonable contract. He'd be one of their bigger scorers next year if LeBron were to leave. But for Cleveland, no reason to like anger him anymore, anger his agent with a fine, draw more attention to this. Everyone knows that this happened. Pretty sad for Hood, who frankly had not played well enough. And he's under a lot of pressure, to be sure, you know, as a free agent this year. I'm sure he was thinking that he was going to get some massive offer. We offered him a pretty big contract in the mock off season. He was averaging, you know, high teens when he was playing for Utah, just has not performed in Cleveland. So certainly this is not gone the second half of the season the way he would have been hoping. This is another interesting one. Paul George underwent an arthroscopic procedure on his left knee today, 6 to 8 weeks. That seems like sort of your meniscus trim, your debridement, that kind of thing. Might shed some light on the fact that he was a little bit below where playoff P has been over the last few years in first round losses.
It could, and he'll still be ready in plenty of time, of course, to for next season. And we don't know where he's going to play. It could be in the city where he underwent his surgery, which was Los Angeles, but we don't know that at this point. And one piece of turnover that we do know for the Oklahoma City Thunder is that Nick Collison announced on Thursday that he is retiring. He has been with that organization for 15 years, made the transition from Seattle to Oklahoma City. And I was critical of the way that Oklahoma City used a roster spot on him this year, just because I thought they needed more depth, but certainly a stalwart for the organization and went through some amazing changes of fortune during his time with the team.
He was a rookie back in 03-04, played a number of years. Yeah, he was on that 05 team in Seattle. That was a renaissance with Ray Allen and Shard Lewis, one of the more underrated offense in NBA history. That one kind of random blip here. They lost in the second round that year in 6 to the Spurs. They played in college, of course, with Kirk Heinrich. He was in the NCAA championship game. They lost to Carmelo Anthony and Syracuse that year in 2003. So great career for Collison. Also just a good lesson to young players that, hey, you know what? Be a good guy, be a good team guy, and you can extend your career. Giannis Haslam is another great example of this, of just by being a good mentor, getting that reputation of being that type of guy, you can extend your career beyond perhaps where your usefulness to actually helping the team game on the floor would. And also noteworthy was Collison for being one of, I think, only two players I could think of where the loophole of renegotiating and extending a player's contract, giving him a big bonus essentially in the year it was renegotiated, and then having an extension that starts at a much lower number. So basically taking future cap space, or taking current cap space and using it to reduce future outlay. Same thing that the Sixers did with Robert Covington going forward.
And Collison's was so significant that they actually had to change the rule in the next collective bargaining agreement to tone it down. And so he is one of the rare players who has a CBA wrinkle that is specifically built on him, which is kind of cool.
In other news, my throat is pretty sore. I had to take a flight to the East Coast. That's never good on your throat. But I think it has to be required that Kostakouvas has engaged his 2018-19 player option for over $8 million per season. Something that I don't think anyone's talking about.
The only real logic to me of having him decline that option would have been if he just really didn't want to be in Sacramento. But yeah. Kostakouvas was not going to get $8 million anywhere else. I don't even think he was going to get $8 million over multiple seasons.
Yes.
So you take that money, you run. Maybe you pray for a Caron Butler, though I don't think that's going to happen. Caron Butler famously picked up his player option and then was cut by the Kings, which was an amazing play. And I don't think that's going to happen with Kufus. He's a nice bench player for them and, you know, can mix and match, though I think they have too many damn centers. But a good decision by him. That's why you negotiate for player options and instead of team options. And it is not Jordan Mickey's fault, but he got a team option instead with the Miami Heat. It was at the minimum, but Miami wisely decided to decline that. So technically speaking, he is an unrestricted free agent. They could bring him back with non-bird rights, but I would not expect to see Jordan Mickey on the Miami Heat next season.
Yeah, Mickey was someone I thought showed promise in his rookie year in the G League, but due to maybe some injuries, due to just not necessarily having the mentality, was not a guy who was able to be that effective. Had a few moments of playing with the Heat due to injuries, but with Miami, have more than enough roster spots tied up in centers between Hassan Whiteside, Kelly Olynyk, and Bam Adebayo, and I think you could even just get a better free agent at the minimum if you need something more at center than what Mickey gave them in the last year. Be interesting to see whether he catches on or not. All right, let's talk a little East Finals here right after this from Lending Club. Whether it's unexpected repairs, medical expenses, credit card debt, a little money can make a big difference, and you can get it at lendingclub.com. They give you access to low rates on loans of up to $40,000 for almost any purpose. Back before I went to law school, I had credit card debt, and Lending Club would have been a great option for me back then. Certainly, they offer lower rates than high interest credit cards, much easier than going to a bank as well. The process there, you just go to lendingclub.com, enter the amount of money you need, and you can find out in minutes if you're approved. Pick the offer that's right for you, and the money can be in your account in just days. Again, a much simpler process than going to a bank. They've been around for more than 10 years, and they've helped millions of people with over $31 billion in loans. Take charge of your finance today with Lending Club. Go to lendingclub.com/capspace, and you can check your rate for free. Checking your rate will not impact your credit score. That's lendingclub.com/capspace. Easy to remember, capspace. We talk about capspace time here on the program. lendingclub.com/capspace. All loans made by WebBank, member FDIC, equal housing lender. So before I was thinking about this, actually. I don't think we're going to spend as much time on this preview as we did on Warriors Rockets made into a separate episode, but I was thinking about this after we recorded, and I was hard-pressed to think of many series, if any series, that between two evenly matched teams, there is as much anticipation for as there should be for this series. Are there any just that you personally, in terms of how much you're looking forward to it before the series, can go back to think of, Danny?
It's hard because you have to balance a couple of different factors. I mean, the 2013 finals and the 2014 finals with the Cavs and the Spurs, or sorry, the Heat and the Spurs, LeBron versus San Antonio certainly fit in there. The Thunder in 2016 were not as great of a regular season group, though they were really good, but after how well they played against San Antonio, that was in the mix. And then also, it gets lost in the shuffle because of how it ended due to injury. But last year, I mean, the Spurs were fabulous during the regular season, and you and I questioned whether they would be able to hang with the Warriors. They did lead by, I think it was 20 when Kawhi got hurt, but this isn't on the short list to be sure. And both teams also so strong on the offensive end, but then also capable defensively, brings it to another level for me and gets it more in line with those Heat Spurs final.
Yeah, I mean, some of these Golden State series, for example, I mean, they've been massive favorites in all these series. Like last year with the Cavs example, they were a big favorite. And this is pre-series too. I mean, obviously there are series that turned out to be awesome. Like Golden State was picked to win in five, I think, by most analysts over OKC in 2016. That was a great series. They were picked in five, probably by most people over Cleveland in 2016. Same thing with last year. So I would be more looking at the ones where it's like, okay, this might actually be considered a toss-up. I would probably have to go back to 13 Spurs, Heat, 14 the Heat, just, you know, we're not nearly as good of it by that point. I mean, I think there was a perception they were dangerous, but I think most people had Spurs at home court series. Before that, I would probably say the 08 finals between the Lakers and the Celtics. By 10, both of those teams were not as good. I think they were considered in 08. The other ones on my list when I first came up with it was Kings and Lakers in 02, and that was just fantastic. Lakers Blazers in 2000 was another one that I think people were really, really into beforehand. And then a couple other series that, you know, ended up being blowouts, but at the time looked pretty good, was 01 San Antonio Lakers. San Antonio actually had home court in that series. They had won in 99. Duncan was hurt in 2000. Lakers won in 2000 and then had a Warriors-esque regular season in 01, but then picked it up, of course, the playoffs. Lakers ended up sweeping that, partially perhaps because Derek Anderson was injured on maybe a dirty play by Juwan Howard in the previous series against the Mavs. And then a couple that KP mentioned, we were talking about this, the two Suns-Spurs series in 05 and 07. And then I think Lakers-Spurs in 04 would have to be another. But this is, I mean, this we get these series maybe, you know, once every two or three years that are this good. And I think I'm just so excited for this one for sure.
And that's not an easy transition into the series we're going to talk about for the next segment. Cavs Celtics. Boston does have home court in the series by virtue of a vastly superior regular season record, but Boston does not, of course, have their full complement of players. And I might have gotten the time a little bit wrong because I used February 9th as the start date rather than, because I don't know exactly when Cleveland incorporated their players. But the Cavs during that stretch from then to the end of the regular season, 115.5 points per 100 possessions, which is the second best offensive rating in the league during that time. They were 21st in defense, but that gets into the first part of that, into what I think is the most important part of the series, which is, can Boston slow down Cleveland? They can't stop him, but can they slow him down? And if so, or actually either way, can Boston score enough to win the series? They can certainly win individual games, but can they score enough to win the series?
We know it's possible, barely, for Cleveland to be slowed down. Indiana did it. Now, Kevin Love, whether it was the recency of that finger injury they had suffered, some other issues, he was so much better in the Toronto series than he was in that Indiana series. I mean, Boston is going to have to force Kevin Love into that type of a series. But I mean, I don't see that happening. I think Love is playing pretty well. He's had one series like that his whole time in Cleveland. I agree with you. I mean, I think it's going to just be really difficult for Boston to done. I mean, we should probably start, as we always have to, with who will get the initial assignment on LeBron James. I think that Tatum is going to be too light in the short to do that. Jaylen Brown has really failed any time he's had to guard LeBron James in the post. Brown is much better against smaller players using his length, using his quick feet than trying to body up, despite the fact that he looks pretty strong. Now, Marcus Morris is someone who has had more success against James bodying him up. Al Horford has not guarded James particularly well in the past, but I think when he's had the assignment on Giannis, Simmons done pretty well there. You know, he's someone you could think about with guarding James, but then, of course, your problem becomes who is going to guard Kevin Love, right? Is that going to Bane? Certainly, I think whenever I think Boston would do well to play more matchup basketball, start Horford, have put Baines in the game basically whenever Tristan Thompson's in, whenever his love is out of the game. You know, Bane could guard Jeff Green if they're going to go super small, or he could guard Thompson, and then you can in those minutes maybe you put Horford onto James. But I think Stevens, he usually has been pretty rigid with his rotation in terms of when he takes out Horford. I think it needs to be a lot more kind of matchup basketball that way. But I think the problem too for Boston is, while they have had some underrated offense game in this playoffs, they're going to struggle to score when Horford is off floor too, and Horford can't play as many minutes, James.
That's going to be a big problem for them, just the having enough minutes, especially if Shane Larkin in a different position. But if Larkin is limited, just having enough bodies that are capable of being a part of this series is going to be a big problem. I do like the number of guys that Boston can throw at LeBron, but I do not like any particular one-on-one matchup that well. That's just because LeBron is an absolute demon. No disrespect meant to Morris or Horford.
Yeah, Ojale is another guy.
Anybody else, really.
Should mention too, will be in the
yeah,
mix.
Yeah,
and a lot of playing time.
And Ojale, he will. And the problem with Ojale is that he's a more extreme version of Anunoby, where having him out there on the floor makes it a lot easier for Cleveland defensively. I mean, because they'll just let Ojale shoot pretty much. And Cleveland can exploit non-factors offensively better than almost anybody, because that's almost their entire MO. They don't do much defending, but they can do that. And so Ojale creates problems. And what are the other ones? Defending LeBron is always important, but I've been spending some time thinking about where Cleveland is going to put LeBron, because my general assumption throughout these playoffs has been that LeBron usually doesn't guard the other team's best offensive forward. But that gets really challenging in this particular series, because, you know, if they're starting Horford at the four, then you have the whole Horford versus Tatum part. But even if they go in a different direction, if you don't put LeBron on Tatum, it creates some big problems, because that's, do you want to put Korver on Tatum? That doesn't look like an advantage matchup. You could even slide J.R. Smith over, but then how do you handle Jaylen Brown and all these other ones? So I think Cleveland's matchups are going to be hard. I don't think it's going to sink them at all in the series, but I want to see what Ty Lue wants to do.
Yeah, they certainly like to avoid LeBron having to guard anyone who's a great shooter or who can do a ton one-on-one. I certainly think he's capable of guarding Tatum reasonably well, but yeah, and you mentioned the idea of Brown too, and Brown, his health is going to be a concern. He was on a minutes limit still for game five. Is this 5 days off? I guess it won't even be that, right? It'll really only be 3 days off. They start on Sunday. Is that going to be enough for him to be able to play more, to really be explosive? I'm guessing probably not, especially because, you know, as he's playing with that hamstring injury, I mentioned, of course, that he's kind of finding a way to fight through it. And, you know, the way you do that is by playing at 75% speed so that you don't make an explosive movement that's going to injure it. But you're still going to have little tweaks to it throughout the game where, you know, I think the more he plays, the longer it's going to take him to recover. So I don't expect him to be fully recovered from a mere 3 days off. But they really need his scoring. And you mentioned that Cleveland doesn't have a ton of depth as far as guys to defend on the wing. And between Tatum and Brown, they should have guys who, at least one of those guys, should have a favorable matchup at all time. The other thing that I think is going to be really difficult for Boston is trying to defend in the post. You mentioned that Brown is not that good at it. I think Tatum is going to be a little too skinny, and Boston is going to want to avoid switching, to be sure, but Cleveland will be going at them hard. If it's going to be Rozier against LeBron, if it's going to be Marcus Smart against LeBron, Smart tries hard, but he could certainly get into foul trouble. We saw last year that Kevin Love just completely brutalized Marcus Smart in the post. He's sort of he and James are kind of the tipping point at which Smart, despite all of his strength and intensity, just still doesn't quite have the physical size to deal with a player like that, which at 6'3", it's amazing he can even get up to close to that level. So there are going to be guys that they can go after, and then of course, what do you deal with? Who are you going to help off of? Boston will do the best possible job of that, but there are only so many ways that you can try to help, and I think they'll also be in decent shape to try and deal with some of that screening action out of the corner, which Zach Lowe wrote a nice piece on. We've been talking about that for a long time between Love and Korver, whether you can avoid the switch on that play or not. That's going to be another really difficult thing to deal with. So I think, you know, if they had Gordon Hayward as well with his size, and then there was really only Kyrie that you were looking at as like, all right, this guy's a massive liability against Love or LeBron down low, they might be a little bit better off, and obviously offensively as well. But I think they're going to have to be a few too many small guys out there for Boston a lot of these times.
This is also going to be a big opportunity for both George Hill and Terry Rozier. Rozier, you know, has looked good overall in the playoffs, and George Hill, after getting back, big part of the Game 7 win against Indiana, and then I thought he did a nice job overall.
He looked
in the series
really
Strano.
Spry in that Game 4. I mean, he was like going between his legs, like losing dudes with spin moves, getting to the rim and finishing. He had a couple couple of dunks, I think, in the first quarter. So if they're getting that level of player, because it is nice to be able to have one other guy who can attack off the dribble off a closeout again.
Right, and it also gives Cleveland some non-LeBron options in terms of running actions, and I'd not say Boston will struggle to shut those down, but it'll give them another look in case LeBron wants to do his vaunted resting during games. That would be an option for it. And I feel like, maybe this is transitioning into picks, I feel like I've undersold Boston in my head a lot during these, even though I did pick them to beat the Bucks. A lot of that was just me not trusting the Bucks. Ended up being well-founded, but anyway. So I feel like there is an element of that, but they also are facing a team now that has a much better idea of how they succeed and has personnel that fits it. Whereas the Sixers, as good as and as talented as they are, and we saw some of this in Game 5, which they lost, that they were still figuring it out. And so I think some of those advantages, this might even be an analog of, even though the Celtics were not this team in the regular season, of one of those kind of teams that overachieved relative to their talent level and then has to face it in the playoffs when they are up against a different kind of team.
Yeah, and we thought that team would be Philly. It was not. But Boston's home court, they are 6-0 at home, including a few pretty miracle wins. They've definitely, Boston has pulled it out in close games, but if the games are close down the end, this is LeBron James now. This is one of the greatest clutch teams of all time, this Cavaliers team. Certainly that has continued into the playoffs. I don't think that the Brad Stevens advantage is going to be as useful when you've got LeBron James now on the other side. So Boston has been winning a lot of these games close with superior execution down the end. The home court, we know that LeBron James is not going to be fazed by that. He's started plenty of series on the road in the East Conference in his career. No issues whatsoever. We saw what they did to Boston in the first games in Boston last year. So I don't think Boston can rely on home court anymore. And worth noting that Boston is only 1-4 on road in these playoffs. So I'm going to pick a sweep. I think the Cavs, one of my worst beat in these predictions was not getting a sweep last year. The Cavs somehow lost that game 3 at home after Isaiah was already declared out for the series. But that was the sweepiest gentleman sweep that's ever sweeped last year. I think I'm going to go with that.
I'm going to go with 5, a little show of respect to the Celtics and what they have accomplished. I think Horford could end up having a big game. You know, Celtics role players can put it together and they can certainly win one game at the Garden. Now, if it's 2-0 going back to Cleveland, I don't think we'll get a redux of last year, which you just talked about as a bad beat. But so I'm going to go Cleveland in 5, and I'm fully prepared to feel a little bit stupid about it. But, you know, I'm good with it, at least for right now.
Yeah, and maybe I think like this year's Boston team is definitely better equipped than last year's team, that even with Avery Bradley, obviously Isaiah Tobler game, Jay Crowder, you know, I think that those guys all been upgraded more defensively when you're talking about playing against Cleveland in particular. They've got Ojeleye now as well. Shane Larkin's not going to play. That I think that'll just be good. That'll mean more Ojeleye. Save Stevens for himself when it comes to Larkin. He's really the one guy that I think they played much, but he has a shoulder injury and they're apparently operating as if not going to play in this series. So yeah, we'll see what happens. I'm rooting for Boston being able to pull something out. I think they can make things more difficult on Cleveland than maybe any team except for Golden State. But even then, you know, there's not a Steph Curry to attack, but you've also got Klay Thompson as the 2 for Golden State, who is someone that LeBron actually has not been that successful trying to post up. And of course, you know, Boston is not a great transition Golden State, you know. So I think Golden State's probably still a little bit better defensively against this Cleveland team Boston is. But I think if you had to construct a team that was realistic that could defend these guys, Boston certainly bright up. But nonetheless, I'm still picking it. All right, you want to talk a little Pelicans offseason here?
Let's do it. Start with some of the fundamentals. The Pelicans are going to be over the salary cap. That is not really big news. The constraint that they're probably dealing with, we don't know this for sure. You know, Tom Benson passed away during this past year. His wife took over the team. Whether Gail Benson is going to be willing to pay the luxury tax is something we just don't know right now. I am treating that as a constraint for the time being. If you do so, if you exclude all of their unrestricted free agents, along with the non-guarantees for DeAndre Liggins and Emeka Okafor, assuming they pick up Darius Miller because they have to, that would leave the Pelicans with $27 million in wiggle room underneath the luxury tax with 9 roster spots spoken for. They do not have their own draft first-round pick this year. So if you count in the minimums and everything like that, that really means if they wanted to bring back both DeMarcus Cousins and Rajon Rondo without dumping any salary currently on their books, they have about $25
million. And before Cousins tore his Achilles, of course, that really would have been impossible. Now, though, I mean, some of the numbers that were being talked about for Cousins of 2 2 to 3 years for something less than the max. I mean, that's something you can start to potentially get a rod. And another reason why I might like that today, I think it's pretty clear that he's not a great fit here. They do need more talent. I don't think that if you're, I mean, because now that's the question, right? They made it to the second round, although maybe they don't next year. And so now the question, they had a great matchup. You know, if they had to go up against, say, like the Wolves or something in the first round, I'm not sure that they'd them or the Jazz or the Thunder. But if you're really trying to get into contention, and that's still despite the fact that they made some steps this year, that's what they need, right? Anthony Davis, only 2 years left on that contract now. This is a critical year. I think if they have a similar season to this year, next year, there's still going to be talk that AD is going to be leaving. Although AD, he made All NBA 2 years in a row, right? Or he will make it this year, almost certain. So that'll be 2 years in a row. So that means he'll be eligible for the designated veteran extension next summer, regardless. So I think any chance of him being traded before they can offer him that, unless he simply says, no, I don't want it, are not going to happen. So he's probably there until at least next summer, but they got to get better next year. I think just like getting completely blown out of the building by the Warriors and ultimately going to make him want to stay, even if it was.
Yeah, the pressure on New Orleans is pretty severe because of Davis's timeline. And it's also challenging because while New Orleans could theoretically clear cap space for the 2019 offseason, because they have a couple of guys, Alexei Ajinsa, Nikola Mirotic among them, who are coming off the books after the 2018-19 season, then you're starting to get right in line because Davis has that player option for 2020-21. So you'd be in the kind of the going into the final year of his contract. And that gives Cousins a lot of leverage because they don't have the cap space to replace him, but he loses leverage because he's coming off this Achilles injury and because they played very well without him. I mean, they won a series in a sweep, an impressive sweep over the Portland Trailblazers, even though the Pelicans will need to do more than that, probably, unless Davis is so risk averse that he just wants to take the designated veteran if it's offered.
Well, and this is another factor too. Cousins is 27 this off, so it'd be 29 years. That is when AD's, if they do keep AD, that his new contract kicks in at $38 million. And so then, depending on how much you pay Cousins, if you're paying him even as much as $25 million per season, between Drew at $26 million, Cousins at 25, and AD at 38, now you're almost at $90 million for the 2021 or the 2019-20 season. No, I'm sorry, that's wrong. It would be the 2020-21 season, and the cap might be $110 million right there. So there's really, with AD making that much and Drew, and you want to bring in Cousins too, I think there's really, in planning for that year, I don't think there'd be any way that all three of those guys could be together if AD is starting the extension. So here is your option, Danny. Let's say that in fact Cousins' value is something like, you know, a 2+1 at $23 million. I don't know if that ends up being what it is. Maybe they'll pay him more than that. You've got that option, or you can use the BAE. Or do they use the BAE on Rondo last year? They did. So
they
or
did.
Was it that might have just been? No, I think that was just part of their MLE, most likely. So they'll have the BAE. They would have the full MLE this year. They would also have Rondo's non-bird rights, by which they could pay him about $4 million, and they would have enough breathing space. They could probably bring back Rondo for that price if he would be willing to come back for that price, and use the BAE and the full MLE. Be close there. Would you rather do that, or would you rather bring back Cousins?
As a point of clarification, are you meaning 2+1 in the way we usually use it, where the plus one is a player option rather than a team option? Ooh, because that makes it even less favorable for them.
Let's not even say that. Let's just say let's not even talk about beyond next year. Let's just say for next year, you can have post-Achilles and Marcus Cousins for $25 million, or you can, and then just fill out with minimums, or you can have Rondo, full MLE, and the BAE.
Temporarily setting aside the human element, I'll get to that in a second. It's just better to talk about in the abstract first. I would rather have door B, the non-Cousins option, just because there's so much of a risk of what is Cousins going to be, and his athleticism for his size has been an important part of Cousins' success so far, and maybe he gets even worse defensively. That could be a big concern. And the human element, though, is important to talk about, because Anthony Davis has to accept that designated veteran. And so if the Pelicans just cut this guy loose, who they traded for, who, you know, they didn't give up a ton to get Cousins, and the team was successful with him. I mean, that the best game they played this entire season with Cousins was the game he got hurt. They beat the Houston Rockets. That was a very impressive win for them. So if that basically would cause Anthony Davis to not sign the designated veteran contract, then I would be willing to take Cousins if it were an understood cost of bringing Davis back.
Yeah, I mean, and you mentioned the human element. To me, part of that is, I mean, let's say it is that Davis wants him back as of now, and you feel like, okay, we can appease it, AD. The history of making moves to appease a star is not good. And so if if it is in fact your evaluation, I'm not sure it would be, but I think it's both of ours. And also, you know, this could be in flux too, right? If they have a guy they think is really going to help them at the full mid level, then it makes it a lot easier to say goodbye to. Because if you don't have that guy, and we could talk about who those guys might be in a second, if you don't have that guy, then it becomes a lot easier to bring back Cousins if there isn't really, you know, much behind door B. So you might be, you know, maybe you start off the offseason by trying to get an idea of what's out there. That's going to inform what your offer is going to be to Cousins. But back to Davis, I'm not sure that that's the case, that he is like, oh, I really need DeMarcus Cousins on this team, that's what I want. But if he does feel that way, making a move just to appease a star has a very bad history. The way to get the guy to stick around is you have the best possible team. And so I think if you're...
Well, good. Yeah, I mean, that's true, but they're already kind of in the situation they are. I mean, it's a lot harder to build that team around Davis now than it would have been 3 years ago and trading away all the picks.
But I'm saying if it's your evaluation that, you know, building in some depth pieces, getting more on the wing, making Davis play center as well, which he kind of doesn't want to, but they've had a ton of success with, I think you have to just go against what he wants right now and just trust in your own evaluation of making the team good. Because whether you appease him or not, if the team isn't good, it doesn't matter whether you've appeased him, he's going to leave. So you got to do what you think is going to make the team the best. And if that doesn't work and he wants to leave anyway, well, he was probably gone regardless.
Let's talk a little bit about what the options theoretically would be with the mid-level exception. The Pelicans' biggest need, pretty clearly to me, is at small forward. They've been playing each one more out of position at the three. I like him as a shooting guard. He's not versatile enough. I mean, we saw Kevin Durant just using him as a ball rack for portions of the series. And I thought Moore did as well as you could expect, given his limitations. And they also had Drew on him and a bunch of other guys. The problem for the Pelicans is, congratulations, you have a need at the most scarce position in the NBA and a position where the players who are available, actually who are starter caliber, actually have enough leverage to get more than the mid-level, even though there are not many teams with cap space.
Yeah, well, let's turn to that now. I mean, who among guys who could realistically be available for the mid-level would you want to get? I mean, the number one guy that sticks out to me is Lukumba Mute. You might even be able to get him for cheaper than that. We'll see. Although, especially if the Rockets beat the Warriors, his price is going to go way up. He'll likely be a big part of that. You know, maybe someone like Garrett Temple could decline his player option in Sacramento. He probably won't be as expensive, but he might have to go for more years. You know, you can go with a flyer route with like a Glenn Robinson the third type of guy. Maybe a Rudy Gay type is someone that you could look at. Gay is a little better defensively this year, though he's not certainly the solution against someone like Kevin Durant. But I mean, it's really other than, and then Danny Green, maybe if he opts out, could be someone that they could look at for the full mid-level. But really, of anyone who even could possibly be available, remember Green's player option $10 million, and he's 31, and he hasn't looked good this last year. It's basically guys who are going to make a difference for you on the wing: Danny Green, Trevor Ariza, although man, if you sign him to longer than 2 years, good luck with that. Lukumba Mute, maybe James Ennis if you want to squint hard. Those are really like the four guys that I'm looking at where you're not going to just get completely worked by Kevin Durant, and you got to beat Kevin Durant if you want Anthony Davis to stick around, or you got to at least do something other than, you know, a gentleman sweep in the second round.
There also are not even that many flyer guys. You mentioned a couple, even, you know, like Travion Graham, I don't think really fits that bill. It's going to be super tough to, and if a player is good enough for the Pelicans, a restricted guy like Graham is good enough for the Pelicans to offer them a bunch of money, then you would expect their team to match, because even though the Hornets are pretty hamstrung, they could evaluate him pretty highly. And then a lot of the other players that are on the market, there are capable wings this year, but most of them are on the shooting guard side, and that's the exact problem that the Pelicans are dealing with in the first place. KCP, Avery Bradley, those guys are capable defenders and can hit threes, but they can't really defend other teams' small forward.
Yeah, and I mean, there's a lot of guys out there who can help them in the regular season that could help them against 25 of the team in the NBA, but that's not what the inquiry is anymore. So congratulations, you got to the second round, and now you got to figure out a way to do even better, and I'm not sure what that is. I also think that the other reason finding someone on the wing is paramount is I think they need to get Rondo. Maybe you can start him, but you can't be as reliant on him defensively. He just loses guys. He's not physical. He can't switch. He's an okay help defender sometimes, but you know, and he's 32. He's only going to slow down. And then on offense, this Pel's offense that was so completely unstoppable, the pick and roll game that was so unstoppable against the Blazers, all of a sudden with Rondo out there, it became so much easier to guard. They put Draymond Green on him. I noted this in Game 5 of that Warriors Pel's game series, that on, this is a very rough estimate just seeing game live, but between 1/3 and 1/2 of Pelican possessions saw an action be stopped by someone helping off of Rajon Rondo. A lot of times that was AD trying to roll to the rim and getting stopped stopped there by someone helping off of Rotto. Rotto, yeah, okay. Couple of possessions, he hit a three. But I think he really can be an offensive liability a lot of the times when he doesn't have the ball in his hands. Obviously, he's massive downgrade. And then on defense, he's just going to not have enough size. I mean, if you could go, if you had a lineup that was decent guy with size, Etuan Moore and Drew Holiday, okay, now you're talking about maybe when we get our worst matchup and we have to switch, we've got Holiday or we've got Moore on someone like Kevin Durant. And that's, you know, Kevin Durant can score on that guy pretty well, but it's not like just a disaster, got to send help immediately. You know, you can live with that matchup happening five times a game. If you throw in Holiday, it has to be the primary guy, and then Rondo is the guy who could get switched on. Now you're in much more trouble than that. So I think that's another thing. I think Rondo, just because he was effective this year, he's a good leader. If you can bring him back for just his non-Bird right, they should do that, but they need to not be relying on him in the playoffs. And my fear is that if they don't bring back Cousin, that instead they would react by giving some of their exception, their full mid-level exception, to Rondo, and that I think would be a disaster.
Especially because they have a lot of other things to consider. Wing is the priority. Emeka Okafor has a non-guaranteed year, but there is a consideration depending on what Okafor wants. If he's willing to take 1 year at the minimum, they could restructure it by declining that, by basically letting him go, assuming nobody claims him, and then bringing him back, because when a player signs a two-year or multi-year minimum deal, the league does not subsidize the difference between second-year salary and what that guy actually makes. So for Okafor's case, a 10-plus-year veteran, that can be a lot of money. So they could try to save a little bit there, and that also is true in terms of the luxury tax and all that. I could totally see that happening if it makes sense for both sides. I believe his is structured as a non-guarantee rather than a team option. It would be smart if they had structured the other way. I just don't know for sure. And if they just wanted to go for a different center, they could certainly upgrade over Okafor if they were willing to spend a little bit more money. I just think that's not necessarily what the Pelicans should do because of the needs other places. I'm having Nerlens Noel, who they actually drafted. You know, having Noel would be awesome. I'd be the Davis Noel combination is something that intrigued me back in the day when they drafted him and immediately moved him in the Drew Holiday trade. But there are a lot of centers that if they were willing to go above the minimum, but because New Orleans has a lot of playing time to offer at bare minimum in the regular season, I could absolutely see somebody just taking that job because it's the best opportunity that's around.
All right, a couple more questions I want to pose here. One is, Cousins is not returned. You can't agree with him on a reasonable contract. Who is the one man that you are going after full bore, full mid-level exception contract for 4 years, close to $40 million?
Oh God, 4 years from Bob Mute scares the crap 31. Out of me.
But I mean, you probably, yeah. That's probably what you're going to have to do. I think we'll see, you know, you're probably underpaying on the front end for some of these guys, but so you got to throw more years. That's your only option.
Yeah, so he'd be my priority though, because forward versatility, can hit open shots, think he fits better, kind of like a superior version of what they wanted Solomon Hill to be. And it sucks that you have to throw money at both those guys because Solomon Hill is still under contract, but I think he's the best one to go.
You might say he's a defensive limitation, but as an off-ball guy, I'd probably rather have him as an off-ball guy than Rondo. And then you just give the ball to Drew Holiday or give it to Etuan Moore, and you'd have to get a backup point guard, but you know, those can be found. That would probably be the guy. I might just hope that he stays healthy, hope that it might end up being a bad contract. That's a risk, obviously. But I suspect, though, so my next question is, I will ask you nicely, but also know that I have a gun in my bag available to use on you if you don't answer the question.
By the way, you don't have to ask me nicely. All I was saying on that back in the day was you don't have to put a gun in my head. I'll answer it without that.
I know.
You can be the wild card and cut the brakes if you want. I just don't enjoy it.
I think it's more realistic though, because that's probably like indicative of the pressure that Dell Demps is feeling now. This is great, right? He finally gets a reprieve from, oh, your job might be in jeopardy, to, oh yeah, but if you don't make this team good this year, AD is probably gonna have to get traded next year. You know, that's like that's plenty of pressure. So I'm just trying to simulate what Demps is going through here. But do you believe that DeMarcus Cousins will be on this team here?
I do. I think they'll figure it out. And the biggest reason why I think it's going to happen is the lack of other suitors, especially if Dallas either gets a more intriguing option in free agency, or the other elephant in the room is if they end up in position to draft somebody. Because if Dallas can get Ayton, if they can get maybe Mo Bamba, I don't know exactly how they're feeling about their big man board. In Carlisle's system, I think DeMarcus would be fascinating, but I don't think he's a requirement. And then you look at the other teams that have max or max-esque space, and they aren't there. And I heartily enjoy certain hypotheticals relating to Cousins. I think that the sign-and-trade prospect is worth discussing and thinking about, because now is when those are going to come back into vogue. The problem is needing, you know, needing three people to turn the key, but meaning both teams and Cousins, is going to be really hard. And let's say it's a Wizards deal. I think it's extremely challenging to A, get the money to work because the Wizards would be hard capped, and B, to get the compensation right where everybody's going to be happy, because the Wizards would probably be trying to do that trade without sacrificing Otto Porter if they can manage it. And I think those are just too, they're intriguing, but I think they're unlikely.
Yeah, and of course, I mean, just the idea that Cousins is going to come back as the same guy, I mean, it's so hard to get that in mind, but I mean, there's really been maybe two or three guys, and these aren't even big men, who have come back at close same level, and one of them was Dominique Wilkins somehow. And that's like, Dominique Wilkins was an elite athlete, you know, I mean, especially, I think we found that for guys who, the worse athlete that you are, the more the torn Achilles seems to affect, so that's probably why it seems to affect big also. All right, I think we can wrap up here, though. Thanks so much for listening. We will be back Sunday night, probably very late, I would guess, because I'll be flying back, but we'll have time to watch the game, talk about it on Sunday, and continue, of course, our off-season preview series as well. Talk to y'all then.